The moment I stepped through the kitchen door, Andrea put down her drink. The content smile melted from her face. Something thumped upstairs, followed by a loud snarl.
What is it?
Andrea bared her teeth.
I don't know. It smells bad.
How bad?
I can't explain it. Bad, like something really big that could eat you, like something you should get away from. I'm a former knight of the order, and I really want to go back to my vehicle and take off just so I don't have to smell it. No wonder the little guy flipped out.
Andrea flicked the box open. Her expression grew long. She took the rose out and waved it at me.
I know, I said. It may or may not be romantic.
It's red.
Yes, and some cultures believe that red roses sprang from spilled blood.
Uh-huh. Keep telling yourself that.
That's my line.
Andrea whipped toward the door.
A car is coming. Sounds like one of your jeeps.
Curran, finally! Something crashed upstairs. It sounded like splintered wood.
Oh, not good.
I walked to the stairs.
Conlin, your daddy is home.
A thing perched on the stair rail. It was furry and upright with oversized arms and curved black claws. Gold eyes stared at me from a face that was half human, half lion.
Holy shit!
I stumbled back.
What is it?
Andrea reached me and saw the thing. Her eyes flashed red. A shrill hyena laugh broke out of her mouth. The small, fluffy monster with Rottweiler fangs gathered himself for a leap.
This should not be happening. Toddlers couldn't maintain half form. That was not a thing.
Calm and soothing, Mother of the Year voice.
Conlin,
I started toward him one step at a time.
Come here. Come to Mommy.
Andrea moved into the foyer from the kitchen, slick and quiet, ready to cut off any attempt at escape.
Step. Another step. Another foot, and I could grab him.
The front door swung open, and Julie stepped inside.
Shut the door!
I barked. Conlin sailed off the rail, bounced onto Julie, knocking her down, and shot outside.
Damn it!
I ran after him, leaping over Julie, and almost collided with Curran. Grendel bounced around us, barking up a storm, because my life required a giant hyper-poodle right this second.
What the hell was that?
My husband snarled.
That was your son!
What?
Which way did he go?
Into the woods!
Julie rolled to her feet. My aunt manifested next to the jeep, a slightly translucent apparition in blood armor.
I told you, she said. I told you not to marry a shapeshifter. You did it anyway. Now this happened.
What do you mean it's our son?
Curran demanded.
What is going on with this family?
Julie brushed off her jeans. Derek sprinted into the driveway.
I heard yelling.
Will everyone shut up?
I snarled. Sudden silence descended on the driveway. There is an 18-month-old running around in the woods in half form. I'm going to get him. Help or get out of the way. I turned and ran into the woods to find my baby. Chapter 4.
Shapeshifters have problems, Era said.
I used tongs to grab the meat off the grill and deposit it onto a platter. During his hunting expedition, Curran had caught and butchered a deer, which I found in the cooler in the back of his jeep, which was a good thing, because I was starving and I was pretty sure he was too. It had taken him approximately 30 seconds to catch up to and apprehend our son. Once I was sure that everything was okay, I left them in the woods and went back to the house. They had been gone for about an hour now, and I had a feeling they would be back soon, looking for food.
The wild is unpredictable, Era said.
I've had a trying couple of days, I told her. Normally, I love listening to a blistering lecture on my failure to choose a proper husband. It's my absolute favorite. But if you don't stop, I will put your dagger into the stables.
Era fixed me with her stare. Sometimes I despair at your lack of respect.
I have the best role model.
She once punched the head priest of Nineveh when he told her to bow. Maybe you've heard of her? She snorted.
He was an insufferable prick.
Takes one to know one.
Your husband loves you, she said. I suppose you could have done worse.
I stopped what I was doing and did an exaggerated double take. My aunt rolled her eyes.
Yes, you could have done worse.
Be still my beating heart. How will I ever deal with such faint praise? Andrea snickered. We both looked at her.
I love the Kate and Era show, she said. You should take it on the road.
I picked up my platter of barely seared venison and carried it inside. Andrea held the door open for me.
As I was saying, Era continued, there has never been a child of the wild within our bloodline. I was hoping that the wild wouldn't manifest, but it did, and now it coexists with our powers inside his body. The might of our magic fuels him. I fear for my grandnephew, for he may be capable of terrible things.
My aunt, the party pooper. Why should he be any different than the rest of us? My aunt opened her mouth and closed it.
Good point.
In the kitchen, Julie pulled 3 loaves of bread out of the oven. She had taken over the baking a couple of years ago and always had starter dough on hand. The bread smelled like heaven. Andrea snuck toward it. You're not invisible, I told her. She stopped and gave me an injured look. I turned to my aunt. Have you ever heard of someone killing a large number of people and then extracting their bones?
How large? Julie asked.
About 200. Julie blinked.
That's a lot of people.
Era mulled it over.
Your grandfather did once.
What?
The tribes of Haiti had gotten themselves a particularly persistent chief called Astu Amur. Big on balls, short on brains. He invaded us 7 times over a 40-year period. Each time we beat them back. But your grandfather, Shalmaneser, finally had enough. So he ordered the heads of their fallen gathered, cleaned, and piled into a large mound, so the next time they came to invade, their army would see what happened to their predecessors.
Why clean the skulls, though? Derek asked. Wouldn't the severed heads be more effective?
Because scavengers are less likely to nibble on a clean human skull than on something with flesh still attached. Besides, having a pile of rotting human heads is unhygienic,
Era said. Of course, when making monuments of human skulls, one must always keep hygiene in mind. How did he clean the skulls?
Domestic beetles, of course, Era said. Fast, thorough, and the flesh is returned to nature.
Scratched your dad off the list. A door swung open. My son stumbled in, still in half form. Relief washed over me. I hadn't realized I had been that worried. Grendel got off his pillow, his tail wagging. Conlan shuffled over to the mutant poodle and crawled onto Grendel's pillow. The big black dog flopped next to him. Conlan hugged Grendel and closed his eyes. Curran followed, still in human form but without shoes. He must have shifted into a lion, then shifted back and put his clothes on. Did you have fun? I asked.
Yes, we did, Curran grinned. Our son is a shapeshifter.
He was so happy, I almost laughed.
Your son is a freak of nature, Andrea offered, munching on a slice of bread. It's not natural for a toddler to have a half-form.
He's a prodigy, Curran told her.
The prodigy made a quiet whistling sound. He was snoring. Grendel lay perfectly still, panting, his eyes shining, and generally acting like being hugged by a sleeping monster child was his highest aspiration in life, and now that dream had been fulfilled.
Freak of nature,
Andrea said again. Curran looked at her. Fine, fine. She waved her hands around. I'm leaving. She grabbed a loaf of bread, snagged a venison steak, and swiped a bottle of sangria off the counter.
I know when I'm not wanted. Kate, you still owe me lunch. I'll let myself out. She disappeared into the hallway. Our front door clicked closed. Curran frowned.
Did she just steal our food?
You're welcome to take it up with Clan Bauda, I told him. But since our son bit their alpha today, I don't know how much ground we can gain there.
He bit Andrea?
Mm-hmm.
Ankle?
Shin, actually. She said his teeth scraped bone.
Good bite, Derek said.
Curran grinned wider. It was good that Jim wasn't here. They would probably high-five. I glanced at Conlon. He was asleep without a care in the world. My life had irreparably changed today. Nothing would ever be the same. I had to figure out how to roll with it by the time Conlon woke up. Curran wandered over casually and snagged a chunk of Julie's bread.
What set him off?
I wiped my hands on a kitchen towel. Do you want to eat first or see the box?
What box?
Derek asked. Curran glanced at my face. His expression hardened.
The box first.
Curran leaned toward the box sitting on the porch table. His nostrils flared. Gold rolled over his gray irises. Derek's upper lip rose, baring the edge of his teeth. He looked like a wolf now, a sharp, feral wolf. What does it smell like to you? I asked.
A predator, Derek said. Never smelled anything like that before.
Are you sure? I asked.
It smells like panic and running for your life, Derek said. I would remember this. Smells like a challenge, Curran said.
Julie frowned at the box. Curran opened it and took the rose out. His voice took on a quiet, measured tone, as if he were talking about the weather.
Interesting.
My aunt focused on the rose.
I've seen this before.
Oh, goody. What is it?
It's an old way to declare war.
Great.
It was used to overcome the language barrier. No translation needed. Submit to our demands, or...
Her translucent fingers brushed the knife.
We'll cut your throats and turn your world to ash.
Better and better. Would father? She shook her head.
This was the way of the Uru, the outsiders, barbarians. Your father is a civilized man. If he were to declare war, he would call you first.
Well, at least I could expect a phone call before Roland unleashed Armageddon and murdered everyone I loved. Julie went inside.
What about the rose?
Curran asked.
I don't know, Era said. Sometimes they put a bag in the box to symbolize tribute.
Pay us and we'll go away? I asked.
Essentially. I've never seen a blossom like this. The rose is the flower of queens. When your grandmother built the hanging gardens, she filled it with roses.
And that was precisely the problem. We knew what a rose meant to us. We had no idea what it meant to whoever sent the box. Julie came back out with a piece of paper and a pencil.
How do we know who sent it?
Derek asked.
Why declare war and not identify yourself?
Era turned to me.
Did you see the messenger?
No.
If we wait long enough, we'll find out,
Curran said, his gaze dark.
They signed it, Julie said.
Everyone looked at her.
The box glows blue, she said, drawing. There is a lighter blue symbol on the lid.
She held the paper up. Two circles joined by two horizontal lines. It looked like an old-fashioned barbell. The alchemical sign for arsenic? I frowned. That made no sense.
Could also be the astrological symbol for opposition, Julie murmured.
I glanced at my aunt. Era blinked.
Isor?
What's Isor? Julie asked. Era stepped down into the yard where the first stars dotted the darkening sky and pointed in the direction of Ursa Major.
Isor, the twin star.
Julie's eyes lit up. Don't do it, I told her. She held her hands out.
Aliens.
No.
Oh, come on. Why can't it be aliens?
Ooh, maybe your whole family is aliens.
I turned and went back to the house.
Where are you going?
Derek called after me.
I need a drink.
I walked into the kitchen. Conlon was still on the pillow, still in half form. Julie's mangled body flashed before me. Half human, half animal, trapped in a hospital bed, sedated to the point of comatose, because the moment Doolittle took her off the sedatives, she would explode into a loop. Anxiety stabbed me, cold and sharp, in the pit of my stomach. I opened the bottle of sangria with a jerk, poured a glass, and drank it down. Curran came through the door. He moved in complete silence. If my peripheral vision were worse, I would have never known he was there. He wrapped his arms around me and pulled me to him. I leaned into him, feeling the warmth of his body. I'd missed this so much. I'd missed him. He breathed in the scent of my hair.
What's up?
He asked, his voice quiet. What if he can't shift back?
He'll shift back. It was an exciting day for him. His hormones are high. He'll burn it off in his sleep.
He kissed my hair. What if he doesn't? My blood is really potent, and the concentration of like V in his bloodstream is off the charts. What if he goes loop?
Curran turned me toward our son, hugging me to him. His voice was calm and soothing.
He won't. Look at him. He's proportionate. Look at his jaws. They fit together. They are well formed. The length of his legs and arms is perfect. He did it instinctually. He didn't struggle. He just did it. With loops, there is a stench. He smells clean.
He rubbed my shoulders. He bit Andrea. He's known her since he was born.
He was scared. That's good.
It sank in. Loops don't get scared.
No, they don't. They blindly attack. The adults can be cunning, but when children go loop, they turn feral.
He kissed me again.
You should have seen him in the woods. He splashed through the creek. He climbed everywhere, sniffed everything, like someone took his leash off. He's our kid. He's got this.
We stood together, wrapped up in each other, watching our son sleep. Andrea called me a helicopter parent.
Andrea needs to shut the hell up sometimes.
I don't have anyone to measure myself against, I told him. I didn't know my mother, and Boron wasn't exactly a model father.
Baby B is a beautiful baby, Curran said. But she's a Bowda. She smells like a were-hyena, she acts like a were-hyena, and other were-hyenas know exactly what she is.
What's your point?
There are no surprises there. He,
Curran pointed at Conlon over his shoulder,
is full of surprises. It will be fun.
I don't want him to end up with my childhood.
Where did that even come from?
A hint of a growl slipped into Curran's voice.
He has me and you. He won't end up like us, and we are not going to end up like our parents. History isn't going to repeat itself. I won't let it.
History had a way of rolling over the best-laid plans like a runaway bulldozer.
Does he know I'm his mother when he's in animal shape?
Yes, I knew my parents were my parents.
But does he know?
He recognized I was his father.
How do you know?
Because I told him to stop and he did.
Maybe he just thought you were a bigger lion.
Trust me, he knows us. Our scent, the sound of our voices. He knows we're his parents.
He knew who I was. He knew who Curran was. Okay. I could do this. I'd done harder things before. The phone rang. I picked it up.
Yes?
Good evening, a familiar voice said. Robert served as Jim's chief of security. Today was a gift that kept on giving. I put him on speaker.
What can I do for you?
I understand you're involved with the Serenby situation.
Word traveled fast.
Yes.
Any chance for a briefing?
Why?
Curran asked.
Karen Iverson's parents owned a house on that street.
I had no idea who Karen Iverson was.
Clan Jackal, Curran said for my benefit. Parents are human. She's first generation.
A shapeshifter had attacked Karen Iverson, and she'd survived it and become a shapeshifter.
Happened often enough. The GBI refuses to let her or us on the scene, Robert said.
It made sense. Karen was a shapeshifter, but her parents were human, which meant the pack had no jurisdiction. GBI likely didn't want to start a panic before they had at least some idea of what they were dealing with.
They won't tell us if they are alive or dead.
They're dead, I told him.
I surmise that. They're blocking us from viewing the bodies. I need to know what we're dealing with before I fill out the necessary court documents to force them to release the remains.
I leaned deeper into Curran, letting the warmth of his body anchor me.
Robert, they can't give you their remains. If it's a matter of a quarantine, we are immune to most diseases.
They can't give you their remains because someone forced 200 people out of their homes and then boiled them. Curran's hold on me tightened.
I'm sorry, it sounded like you said...
Boiled? I explained the puddle. Robert didn't say anything. The kitchen was quiet.
Can we meet tomorrow?
He asked finally.
Yes. Cutting edge at 9? We'll be there, Curran said.
I hung up.
Sorry, he said.
What for?
For being gone.
Did you catch the magic leopard monster?
I did,
he said.
Then it's all good. I'll make it up to you. What do you need? He asked.
I glanced at Conlon. Think he'll be out for the next couple of hours?
At least.
In that case, I put my arms around him and kissed him. It wasn't a tender kiss. I hadn't seen him for 3 days. The world had turned grim while he was gone, and I wanted him to know just how much I had missed him. His lips seared mine, the familiar taste of him washing over me, harsh and male. Every nerve in my body stood at attention, and I shivered. Then my feet were off the floor, and we were moving up the stairs at an alarming speed.
Don't want to wait until after dinner?
I murmured into his ear and licked the corner of his jaw, tasting the rough edge of his stubble.
Fuck dinner,
I laughed, and he closed the bedroom door behind us. Chapter 5
Natenid! Natenid!
Curran took his gaze off the road to glance in the rearview mirror for a second.
You okay there, buddy?
Natenid!
No, I told Conlon. My morning started with Curran kissing me, which was very welcome, at which point we discovered that our son had shifted back into a human in the middle of the night because he climbed onto our bed in all of his nude glory, slapped his belly, and yelled, Natenid! Then he grabbed himself in case we missed his point. After Curran stopped laughing, I handed our child over to him and escaped into the bathroom. Conlon had been yelling Natenid since I packed him into the car seat 20 minutes ago. He'd clearly decided that clothes were overrated. At least he'd stayed human. Usually we had a line of people willing to watch him, but he could decide to go furry at any second, and if he did, both of us wanted to be there. So he was coming with us to meet with Robert. Outside the Jeep, Atlanta crawled by. Magic drenched the city. I always felt it, a kind of invisible sea, shallower here, deeper there. But ever since I claimed my little chunk of the planet, the invisible currents had gained definition. If I concentrated, I could sense them ebbing and flowing. It freaked me out, even after all this time, so I tried not to think about it too hard.
Natenid!
Conlon yelled to be heard over the sound of the engine.
He needs a deer leg bone to gnaw on. Curran said. They were my favorite.
Can it be a cooked leg bone?
He is a shapeshifter, Curran said. You know we don't have to worry about bacteria and diseases.
What about intestinal parasites?
I've been eating raw meat for all of my life and never gotten a parasite.
I would feel better if it was cooked.
Curran studied me for a moment, reached over and squeezed my hand.
Still having a hard time with the shapeshifter baby thing?
No. I love him, whoever or whatever he is, but I spent 18 months worrying that he would stop breathing at night or get sick or become injured, and raw deer femurs don't go along with that.
Cooked bones splinter. He'll hurt himself.
It's funny how you use logic in an argument and think it will persuade me.
He is still teething. He'll need something to gnaw on.
On one hand, a clean Conlan eating cereal. On the other hand, covered in blood, gnawing on a deer leg.
Which one seems more like your kid?
Curran asked. I gave him the look of death. He laughed.
Okay, I told him, but if he gets worms, it's on you.
Curran turned onto Jeremiah Street.
I let him eat a mouse in the forest yesterday.
Of course you did. Why wouldn't you let your baby eat some filthy rodent in the woods?
He caught it himself. I'm not going to take his kill away from him.
Oh, why me? We parked. Curran shut off the engine and turned to me. His eyes had turned dark.
Don't leave me, Kate.
Where did that come from?
I mean it, he said. I've got your back.
And I had his. That's why when my father finally showed up to fight us with his army, I would do whatever I had to do to make sure he and Conlan survived, no matter the cost.
I love you, I told him, and got out of the Jeep.
The Alpha of Clan Rat slipped through the doorway of Cutting Edge as if his joints were liquid. Of average height, Robert Linesco had a slim build. His hair was coal black, his eyes brown and velvety, and he turned heads whenever he entered the room. He was also happily married to his husband, Thomas, and had no plans to change that anytime soon. Conlan, who had been running around the tables in a circle, sighted Robert and went into a crouch. Robert raised his eyebrows and took a step forward. The shift was instant. One second normal, well, mostly normal, human child. The next an oversized black lion cub. Robert's jaw hung open. He actually did a double take. I didn't blame him. Conlan made an adorable lion cub. At least he hadn't gone into warrior form again.
Congratulations,
Robert finally managed.
Thank you.
Curran said, his face nonchalant, as if nothing notable were happening. My son shrugged the shreds of his clothes off himself and showed Robert his lion fangs.
Roar!
Is he challenging me?
Robert's eyes sparkled. I put my hand over my face.
Roar!
That's the most adorable thing I've ever seen. Conlan,
Curran said, putting some growl into his voice.
Come here.
Rawr.
Curran got up and strode toward Conlan. My kid lunged sideways, but Curran was too fast. His hand snapped out, and he lifted Conlan by the scruff of his neck.
No.
Conlan settled into his father's arms, eyeing Robert like he was a cobra. We were currently in waiting mode, gathering strength for the time my father decided to invade us. But if I somehow survived and I got to raise my son, I was in for a hell of a time.
I want one, Robert declared.
What's stopping you?
Curran asked.
We've talked about it.
Robert sat in the chair in front of my desk.
We're not sure if we'd go the adoption or surrogate route. In any case, the timing isn't quite right.
The timing is never quite right, I told him.
How are you handling this?
Robert asked me. Last night, my husband let my 13-month-old spend an hour in the woods, rolling in the creek mud and eating raw mice, and then my son passed out on the dog pillow hugging Grendel.
Robert winced. I can see how that would be disconcerting. Did you have to sterilize the child after he touched that creature?
Ha ha. I picked up the file I'd put together last night and handed it to him. Everything we have. Biohazard did a quick walkthrough with a portable M-scanner. The copies of the printouts are in there, together with copies of my notes and Derek's notes. I'm very sorry, Robert. Thank you.
Robert accepted the file. His expression turned serious.
I have some news to trade.
It's not nice news, is it? I asked. Robert pulled a photo from his pocket and put it on the table. A tall man on top of the roof of a ruined building. His trench coat sewn together from patches of different leathers and hides flared as he walked across a steel beam protruding over a sheer drop. The beam had to be less than 6 inches wide. Wind stirred the man's black hair.
Razor, I said.
I'd recognize that green-skinned bastard anywhere. When my father felt my aunt waking up, he created a cult of assassins raised to kill her if she became a problem. He called this order of assassins the Sahanu, after an ancient word that meant to unsheathe the dagger. He fed them all sorts of bullshit about the divinity of our blood. The Sahanu lived for a single purpose, to kill at my father's command, so they could be granted heavenly afterlife. Their highest goal was to murder one of our blood. My aunt, except I killed her first, me, my son. My father had skated very close to the invisible line that people in our family didn't cross. Era reminded me of it at least monthly. Whatever you do, don't become a god. Faith had no power, and once your followers believed in you, your thoughts and actions were no longer your own. Not to mention that the more people believed in you, the closer to godhood you came, and gods couldn't exist in our reality, not permanently. They required magic for manifestation, and the tech shift would wipe them out. Roland had sidestepped the issue by making the blood divine instead of himself personally, but if the Sahanu grew in numbers, he would have a serious problem on his hands. His ability to move freely in our world would be compromised, too dependent on belief and magic. Sahanu were fanatics, immune to reason, bribery, and pressure. I had managed to break one of them free of Roland's grasp almost 2 years ago. Adora was still learning to be a person. During her last birthday, she disappeared right before her surprise party. We turned the city inside out looking for her. Given that she was one of the most skilled killers I've ever fought, I was sure something bad had happened to her, or because of her. She came out of the woods 24 hours later, covered in mud. She'd seen some baby otters and followed them around the creek all day. Adora was ranked fourth in the Sahanu ranks. Razor was ranked first.
Where was this taken?
Curran asked.
Sandy Springs.
Shit. Razor wouldn't have entered my territory unless he had orders to be here.
Is Roland moving?
Curran asked. Robert nodded.
We are receiving reports of increased traffic to Jester Park.
He's pulling in his troops,
Curran said.
It would appear so, Robert agreed.
My father is about to restart the war. I leaned back in the chair. Now? He was doing it now, when we had all this other crap to deal with? His timing couldn't be worse.
Conlon gathered himself and jumped off Curran's lap, clear across the table to me. I caught him, but the impact of 40 pounds rocked me back. He licked my cheek.
I knew we had been living on borrowed time. The sands had just run out.
Where does the pack stand?
Curran asked quietly.
Jim and I discussed it, Robert said. Jim's first loyalty was to his people. The pack lost a great deal in the battle with Roland. 62 shapeshifters never came back to the keep alive. 19 of them were under 20. I remembered the bodies and the crying, the din of wailing that rose through the keep when the bodies were retrieved. I still sometimes heard it in my sleep. Fighting my father without the pack's help would be very hard.
I'm here to tell you that the pack will not stand against Roland unless directly attacked, Robert said.
It hit me like a punch to the stomach. I had suspected this was coming, and it still hurt.
Given that the Atlanta metropolitan area is home to roughly 1,800 shapeshifters at last count, we consider any attack on the city to be a direct attack on the pack.
Robert continued.
Wait, what?
Which is why I'm authorized to bring you an offer of mutual aid. In case either your family or the pack becomes aware of a city-side threat such as Roland's invasion, we agree to assist each other.
Curran had his inscrutable face on.
Will the Beast Lord put it in writing? I asked.
If you insist, Robert said. But a verbal agreement should be sufficient. It was passed as a resolution by the Pack Council, so it's on record.
You realize that after he dealt with us, he would come after you, and he would crush you alone,
Curran said. Pretty much, Robert said. We need you, and you need us.
I looked at Curran. Are you comfortable with that offer?
He mulled it over. I petted Conlon's furry head. He yawned. Running around in the office and changing shape really made him tired.
Is Roland named as the specific threat in the resolution?
Curran asked.
Yes, Robert confirmed.
I'm fine with it.
Robert looked at me.
Kate?
We agree, I told him.
Excellent. He took the folder off the table. Thank you for this.
Any time.
And, Robert, could you please not mention that Conlon shifted? Robert narrowed his eyes.
Trying to avoid the stampede of excited shapeshifters?
Yes.
My lips are sealed.
He walked out. We stayed silent for several minutes. Shapeshifter hearing was excellent, and Robert's was off the charts.
That went better than expected, I murmured finally.
They need us, Curran grimaced. I wish we had more time.
My heart cracked. Me too. I had things to do. I would need to visit the Witch Oracle and let them know that we had to go ahead with the plan of last resort. My husband and son would survive this.
The door of Cutting Edge swung open, and Teddy Joe walked in, frowning. Knocking, it's a thing, I told him. You make a fist, lift it, and gently hit the door to let the person inside know you are out there.
Teddy Joe shook his head.
Kate, there is some weirdness happening outside.
Weirdness seemed to be stalking me.
I got to my feet and stepped outside, Conlon in my arms. Sunshine bathed the street, and 13 people waited there, about 30 yards from our door. Long, white robes with deep hoods hid their faces and swept the ground, shifting in the breeze. They stood in two columns, 6 people on each side, their arms crossed, their hands tucked into their sleeves, with a lone figure in a blue robe waiting between them.
Magic brushed against me. It felt old and deep.
The figures didn't move.
Is this a present from your father?
Curran asked quietly.
I don't know.
It felt like him, though. Ancient, dark, but oddly beautiful. Maybe this was his version of that phone call Era was talking about. Curran put his hand on my arm. His eyes had gone completely gold. The hair on his arm stood on end.
What is it?
Derek's not loop sent.
The figure in the center raised his arms. The blue robe slid down, revealing a young, dark-haired man, barely older than a boy. He was nude and built like a Greek statue, every muscle perfect. Dark blue eyes looked at me from a beautiful face. A gash crossed his chest, carved deep into his flesh, and in the depths of the cut, golden sparks flashed as if he smoldered from inside.
"Daughter of Nimrod!"
the boy called out, his voice accented.
I await your answer.
He lowered his arms to his sides and smiled. The wound on his chest sparked and ignited from the inside. Fire licked his flesh, spreading from the wound. The stench of burned human meat washed over me.
What the hell?
He kept smiling. His skin bubbled and he kept smiling. I spun to Teddy Joe and thrust Conlon into his arms. Wings shot out of Teddy Joe's back. Wind fanned me, and then he was on the roof, out of the way, holding my son. The door to Nicole's automotive repair banged open, and Mr. Tucker charged out, his placard clutched in his hands.
Don't!
Curran and I barked in the same voice. Mr. Tucker grabbed the nearest hooded figure.
Your friend is on fire!
A furry arm thrust out of the robe. Claws locked on Mr. Tucker's windpipe, squeezed, and Mr. Tucker fell. His eyes shocked. A clump of his bloody flesh clenched in the creature's claws. It happened fast, so fast it only took a fraction of a second. Surratt was already in my hand and I was moving. The 12 figures dropped their robes. White fabric flew, revealing bodies sheathed in short brown fur. They stood on two legs, hunching forward, their muscled arms dangling, each finger tipped with a claw. Their round heads leaned forward, their mouths wide slashes betraying yellow fangs. Big round eyes stared at me, cold and empty, like the eyes of an owl. A memory punched me, sharp and vivid, borrowed from my aunt. A room in an ancient palace, shrouded in veils, the body of a child, and an abomination that looked eerily like these chewing on the stump of my uncle's neck. Curran shot past me and roared. The sound of his fury was like thunder. It punched the beasts. They screeched and cringed back in ragged unison. The world turned red. Every instinct in my head screamed. They'd killed one of my people. They were an abomination, a corruption. They had to be purged. Rage boiled inside me. The beasts rushed us. The first creature swiped at me, raking the air with its talons. I shied away from its claws and slashed at it. Surratt sliced through flesh like it was butter, cleaving the beast's chest. Blood spattered me, drenching me with foul magic. The beast screeched and swiped at me. I shied left, ducking, and cut across its outstretched arm, severing the extensors. The hand went limp. I thrust Surratt into its side, puncturing the stomach and the liver, and freed the sword with a sharp tug. The beast dropped to its knees and surged back up. I buried Surratt in its chest and kicked it off the blade. Tough bastards. A second creature tore at my back, the tips of its claws carving straight through reinforced leather into the skin. My back burned. I spun around, slicing in a frenzy, cut its jugular, spun around again, and severed the first beast's spine as it tried to rise again. The second creature collapsed, blood pouring from its neck, and squirmed on the ground, raking at me with its claws. I beheaded it. Two down. A body flew, knocked out of my way. Curran tore through the creatures, snapping bones and ripping flesh, his hands clawed, but the rest of him still human. A third beast lunged at me. I dropped down, cut its femoral artery, and spun out of the way as it fell. It crawled toward me. I stomped on the back of its neck. Die, you damn bastard! The boy was still burning. Ash formed on his chest, but he was still smiling, his eyes tracking me. How the hell was he still alive? Behind me, a sharp lupin snarl cut through the air. Derek lunged at the creature on my right, a short sword in his hand, and chopped through its arm with a brutal swing. To the right, Julie spun, the twin tomahawks in her hands chopping. The kids had arrived. My shoulders and thighs burned from the scratches, and the gashes in my back simmered as if someone had poured salt into the wounds. Only four creatures left. A blast of magic rocked me, nearly taking me off my feet. Some massive power had just broken through the boundary of my territory from above. I spun around. In the northwest, a fireball tore through the clouds. Teddy Joe swooped over us, his hands empty. Where was Conlon? I spun around and saw Julie holding him.
Kate!
Teddy Joe pointed toward the fireball.
I've got this.
Curran snarled next to me.
Go!
He gripped my waist and threw me up. I shot up 10 feet into the air. Teddy Joe caught my arms and pulled me up to him, locking his arms around my ribs, and then we streaked through the air toward the column of smoke. Note to self, once this is over, explain to my husband to never throw me like that again. The ruined streets slid under me. Wind tore at my face. The column of smoke drew closer. The area above it boiled with magic. Something terrible was happening up there.
Fly faster! Don't make me drop you!
Seconds ticked by. Roofs rolled under us, followed by ruins, then more roofs, and then we were in the unnamed square.
The pillar of smoke rose from the middle of the street. Teddy Joe dived. 10 feet above the road, he let me go. I dropped down and rolled to my feet. The street was empty. I spun around, looking for the enemy. Where the hell are you, bastard? Magic punched at me from above. I jerked my head up. Above, in the thick, low-hanging clouds, something flashed with bright red. Magic pealed like a giant bell, vibrations shaking the ground. Shit! Teddy Joe snarled. A sword appeared in his hands and burst into flames. Something tore through the clouds, glowing red, and plunged to the ground. I dove out of the way. Teddy Joe veered to the side. The object crashed into the pavement like a cannonball, steaming. The asphalt around it softened, melting. I ran toward the glowing thing, Surratt ready. A wall of heat blocked me. I pushed through it, shielding my eyes with my hand. The red glow was fading. A body sprawled on the pavement. Young, about 20, male, probably Chinese, his shockingly beautiful face torn and mangled. I knew him. He'd gone to school with Julie. His name was Yu Fong. He'd come to the house to study once or twice with Julie and Ascanio, and he and Ascanio had spent the entire study session glaring at each other. He had fallen for at least 5 seconds, maybe more. What the hell was going on? Magic crackled in the clouds above me. The intensity of it took my breath away. It pressed on me like a massive hand. It wasn't just old. It was ancient, the way mountains were ancient. Every hair on the back of my neck rose. I planted my legs and drew on the currents around me, calling to my land, shaping the magic it breathed into a shield. Phantom wind spun around me. The chunks of fractured pavement shuddered, rising slightly, grasped by the stream of magic surging up. Above me, the clouds churned. The magic flowed to me, and I built it above the three of us. A dark shape slid through the clouds, so huge my mind refused to accept that it was real. It was there. And then it vanished into the sky, melting into the mist. I braced myself inside the maelstrom of magic, my hands raised at my sides, and grinned at the sky. Come on, I have a score to settle! The dark shape hovered above me, hidden by the clouds, but emanating magic like a lighthouse amidst light. Bring it! Let's see what you've got! It hesitated. Fine. I pushed. The magic shield I built above us split. A geyser of power shot up. The thing in the clouds streaked away from me, climbing higher with alarming speed. A moment, and it vanished. I waited. A tense minute crawled by. Another. It was gone. Teddy Joe landed by me. What in the blazes was that? I don't know. I released the magic, smoothing it back into its natural state, and crouched by Yu Fong. The heat had subsided. I reached over the still warm asphalt and touched his neck. A pulse. I couldn't even tell from how high he'd fallen. 1,000 feet, 2,000, more. He didn't look completely broken. And he was breathing. I reached out, trying to sense his magic. Nothing but a mere hint. Every drop of his power was directed inward. Teddy Joe swore. I turned to him. He's breathing. Please go back to Curran and tell him we need a vehicle.
Stay alive!
Teddy Joe spread his wings and soared into the sky. Chapter 6. I crouched by Yu Fong's body. The bruises on his face had turned bright red. The gashes closing and smoothing over so fast I could actually see his flesh moving. The fingers of his right hand jutted at an odd angle. Broken. His clothes hadn't burned off. He'd fallen from a catastrophic height, so hot he melted the asphalt, but his baited jeans and gray t-shirt weren't even singed. Curran came running around the corner and sprinted to me, sweat soaked his hair and forehead. He hadn't bothered with the car. I straightened.
He almost skidded to a stop and grabbed me, squeezing me to him. My bones groaned.
Okay?
He asked.
Okay,
I squeaked.
Conlon?
He let me go, kissed me, and looked me over as if he didn't believe me.
Teddy Joe has him. He's locked himself in the office.
Oh, good. It would take a tank to break into Cutting Edge.
Look,
I pointed to Yu Fong. Curran's eyes narrowed.
I know this kid.
Yes, he's been to the house. Used to go to school with Julie.
What is he?
I have no idea, I told him. But he's something. Distant water engines roared.
Are the kids okay?
They're fine.
People began to emerge from the surrounding office buildings. The morgue at the eastern end of the square glowed pale blue. Its wards must have activated, which wasn't exactly surprising. Anyone with a crumb of magic in a 3-mile radius would have felt that explosion. Being directly under it was like standing inside one of those ancient church bells while the priests pulled on the ropes. It had rattled through my skull, and I had better defenses than most of the people in Atlanta. Pad would be here soon, and then we'd have uncomfortable questions we couldn't answer. It would eat a day, maybe more, and we didn't have a day to spare. We had to move Yu Fong. He'd fallen from the clouds, so jostling him wouldn't exactly make it worse. Our two jeeps rolled into the square and stopped, just in time. Julie jumped out of the first one, and Derek followed her from the second. Honey? I asked. Curran reached over, grasped Yu Fong by his t-shirt and jeans, and lifted him out of the warm asphalt. I caught the body for a brief second, and Curran picked him up into his arms as if Yu Fong were a child, and carried him to the nearest jeep.
Yu Fong?
Julie ran over.
Is he okay?
He just fell from the clouds, I said. How is he still alive?
He is a Suwanee.
I blinked. According to Chinese myths, the dragon had 9 sons, each with a female of a different species. A Suwanee was the hybrid of a lion and the dragon, a being of fire. That made Yu Fong the closest thing to a dragon to be found in Atlanta. Julie, he's been to the house. Why didn't you tell me? She waved her hands.
It didn't come up.
What do you mean it didn't come up?
Curran growled.
Damn it.
The next time you bring a half-dragon to the house, I want to know about it. That's the kind of essential information I should have.
He's just a guy I went to school with. We don't make a big deal about it.
Ugh.
Can he regenerate?
I don't know. I never asked.
I think so. Dolly would know. They've met before. He calls her White Tiger, like it's her name.
Does he shapeshift?
Curran gently loaded Yu Fong into the back seat.
Sort of. I've never seen him go all the way. He usually doesn't need to. He makes fire. Fire's usually enough.
Can he fly?
I don't know.
Julie spread her arms.
Arg.
I climbed into the jeep. Curran got behind the wheel and stepped on the gas. We rolled toward Cutting Edge. Behind us, Derek and Julie jumped into the other vehicle. I gripped Surratt. Thin tendrils of smoke stretched from the blade, licking the air.
Talk to me,
Curran said.
They killed Mr. Tucker.
They'll pay,
Curran said.
He never did anything to anyone.
I know,
he said.
I know.
The jeep jumped over a bump in the pavement.
Have you ever smelled anything like that?
I asked. Have you seen one of those assholes before?
No.
But I had. The memory stabbed me cold and sharp. Surratt hissed. Curran glanced at me.
Tell me.
Did my aunt ever tell you how my family died? I asked.
She mentioned a war.
An army invaded them. They came from the sea. They had powerful magic unlike anything she had seen before, and they brought a horde of creatures with them. While my father and Era were gone to a summit with other kings, they were betrayed. When my aunt and my father returned, they found their brothers and sisters murdered and creatures gnawing on their bodies. When I shared my memories with Era,
she shared hers with me. The vision of a creature clutching the headless body of a child and gnawing on the red stump of his neck flashed before me. They looked like that. Similar.
Similar, but not the same?
Curran asked. Era's creatures were gray and hairless. These were brown and had fur, but they felt the same. Like corruption. Like something that had to be undone.
Something that smells like a loop and shouldn't exist.
Yes.
We need to save one for her,
he said.
I want her to look at it. What else did she tell you about them?
They came from the Western Sea, the Mediterranean. Shinar never feared an invasion from the sea before.
Why?
Curran asked. Sidonians, I told him. Ancient Phoenicians. The way Era tells it, they called the sea their father, and sailed it to raid and to sell their purple dyes. The Sidonians built walled cities inland, farther in the hinterlands, to give invaders a target. When the attacking army disembarked, the Sidonians would melt into the highlands and cut at the enemy as it marched toward the nearest city, slicing a piece there and a piece here, and vanish back into the wilderness.
They bled them out,
Curran said. Yep. By the time the army got to the city, their morale was in tatters. If any invaders managed to survive and make it back to the sea, they'd find their ships had new owners. The Sidon had one main port, Tyre, a big merchant city, huge walls, guarded harbor with chains across its entrance, and sea beasts guarding the water. A fortress, impregnable. I paused. My aunt told me that she met a man who had escaped from Tyre. He told her that they had gone to bed with clear seas, and when they woke up, they couldn't see the water because the harbor was filled with sails. The ships rained monsters. The invaders weren't an army. They were a horde. They had magic creatures that stank of corruption, unkillable soldiers, and they burned what they took to the ground. Nothing was left standing. It was all ash.
Like the box, he said.
Like the box. We drove in silence. He wants an answer, I ground out. Gold flashed in Curran's eyes. He bared his teeth.
Oh, we'll answer. It won't be vague, and he won't like it. I promise you that.
Good. Curran steered the jeep onto Jeremiah Street. Carnage spread across the asphalt in front of Cutting Edge. Grotesque bodies, torn and mangled, strewn on the pavement, wet with blood. Mr. Tucker lay crumpled on the street, small and somehow almost lost in all the gore. In the middle of it all, a man-shaped pillar of pale gray ash rose. Did he ever stop smiling? I asked.
No. Held it until his eyes cooked in his head.
This was above my pay grade. I had no idea how to deal with this sort of magic. That was okay. I was a quick learner. Bill Horn came out of his tinker shop as we parked. Bill repaired pots, silverware, and anything that was made of metal. He also sharpened knives, and he was carrying a Bowie knife large enough to kill a bear. He was short, broad-shouldered, bald, and he looked like he'd be difficult to move if he braced himself. He walked over to where I crouched by Mr. Tucker's body. It used to be a man. He'd said hi to us. I'd brought him iced tea. Now it was just a corpse. A split second and a life ended.
Not your fault,
Bill said. Yeah, it is. I could have yelled at him to not come close when he first stumbled onto the street.
He wouldn't have listened. The man had no goddamn sense. It's not you, it's this.
He indicated the bloody street with a slow sweep of his hand.
It's the shift.
I didn't say anything.
He was a nut,
Bill told me gently. Yes, but he was our nut. Curran came up and rested his hand on my shoulder. Bill looked at Mr. Tucker's corpse, looked at the slaughter, then looked back at Curran.
You folks need any help?
We got it,
Curran told him.
Thanks. Sorry about the mess.
Bill nodded again.
I was thinking of visiting my daughter up in Gainesville.
Good fishing up there,
Curran said.
Yeah,
Bill said. My son-in-law told me he pulled a 30-pound striped bass out of Lake Lanier. Can't let him beat my record.